Today is Friday, May 14, 2010. This is Kevin Collins. And today's interview is with Romano Mazzoli, former congressman for 12 terms from 1970 to 1994 for the 3rd Congressional District of Kentucky. It's being recorded at the University of Louisville Archives as part of the Romano Mazzoli Oral History Project. Good morning, Congressman.
Good morning, Kevin. Good to be with you.
Pleasure. Just to start off easily, now that you're retired, do most people still refer to you as Congressman out of respect for the number of years you were in Congress?
They do, as a matter of fact. The other night it was at a political event. As a matter of fact, a person asked, you know, what I prefer to be known as or called or addressed, and I said, well, you can call me Ron, you can call me whatever, but typically people say Congressman. Mm-hmm. And it's stuck with me all these years. I think the term is honorific. It's like a judge is, once a judge, always a judge. Once an ambassador, always an ambassador. So once a member of Congress, basically the same thing prevails, always a member of Congress. So I'm addressed as Congressman Mazzoli, but because I grew up here in Louisville, born here, as was Helen and our children, most of the people continue to call me Ron because we're pretty much on a first name basis.
Mm-hmm. Well, today we're going to try and cover in this first session mostly biographical material, growing up in Louisville and so forth. So, maybe you could tell me your sense of the city of Louisville from you were born in 1932. Mm-hmm. So from 1932 through 2010 now. Just a panoramic view of the city and how it's changed and your sense of it.
Well, I could probably characterize Louisville, Kentucky as I probably would any city that I would have been born into as being basically part of the Ice Age back in 1932. I mean, that was, you know, 77 years ago and before television, before interstate highways, before jet travel by air, before Twitter and before internet. I mean, so basically it was a hugely different city. It was a beautiful town, wonderful place. You used to be able to go walk right down to the Ohio River. You didn't have the Esplanade as you have now. You didn't have the riverfront development. You literally walked cobblestones down to the lapping water of the Ohio River. It was a small town, didn't have the same number of people that it has today. But it was a great place, I think, to grow up into. And we grew up, we were born, when I say we, my brother and sister and I were born, in the highlands of Louisville, in the area of roughly Eastern Parkway and intersection with Bardstown Road. We went to school very nearby at St. James Parochial Schools, and my brother and I went to St. Xavier High School, which at that time was at 2nd and Broadway. So we lived in one area of town, and one aspect of Louisville that I only learned about laterly, which was when I decided to get into politics, which was decades later, was the breadth of the city and its diversity, because we tended to live and grow up, get jobs, marry, all within a certain neighborhood. Louisville, as you've heard, is a city of neighborhoods. And so it was providential that politics came along in a way, because it really taught me a lot about myself, and we'll talk about that as these interviews go on. But it also taught me about my city, because it made me go beyond the confines, if you want to call them that, or beyond the parochial boundaries of the Highlands or Germantown or Crescent Hill or St. Matthews into the broader community. So while I grew up in Louisville, Louisville of those days, Kevin, was certainly not the Louisville of today in size, scope, sophistication, or anything like that. But it was a wonderful city to grow up in, and I'm happy that when Mother and Dad married in 1930 and they married in Cleveland, that they decided to come to Louisville rather than to stay in Cleveland. We could have. I mean, that was an option that Dad and Mother had. But Dad was, of course, an immigrant, and came right after he transited Ellis Island. He and his father, who soon thereafter passed away, but they came right directly to Louisville. So the option was, do you stay in Cleveland where Mother's extensive family was, or do you come to Louisville? and they came to Louisville. I'm very happy. We made many trips to Cleveland during the time my family was still intact and my grandparents were alive, but I'm happy that we grew up in Louisville and enjoyed the city. My first recollections of growing up were in Jager Avenue, 1609 Jager Avenue. I pass it periodically because it's not far from St. Agnes Church, where two or three times a week I go to a liturgy. And I remember as little kids, and we have a lot of pictures to document it, the somewhat bucolic life that we lived in that backyard. And my dad, who was quite a talent, somehow dug a pool for us. Now, it wasn't a pool with circulating pumps and things like you'd have today. It's a pool you filled with a hose, and eventually it evaporated. But it was a pool that we enjoyed very much in the summertime, and neighborhood kids came over. I remember having pictures taken in the front room. I have some pictures which I'll show you and put as part of this archival material. I had a favorite toy. It looked like, as best I can tell, it was a giraffe, of all things, which I played with. And I was, as a boy, apparently a very attractive child. My mother submitted my picture into several little these competitions for the prettiest baby of XYZ. And I won a few medals and little awards, and I'll put them in the archives as well. Of course, the intervening years have changed that beautiful little child, you know, that angelic, cherubic little child, into something far different. But in those days, I was. So I have great recollections of Jager Avenue. When we talk about our family, we'll get more into this, but my grandmother, my dad's mother, lived with us. She had just come from Italy before the Second World War, and because Italy was a not an ally of the United States in the Second World War, she was barred from going back to Italy until after the war, and then they started transportation again. So she lived with us, and she was a very...
What was her name?
Her name was Angelina, A-N-G-E-L-I-N-A. Mm-hmm. Rosa Mazzoli, Angelina Rosa Mazzoli. But she was a very wispy kind of woman, narrow and thin, strong, but narrow and thin. And we have many pictures of her, which, again, will be in the archives. But I remember that because she spoke no English, we communicated in Italian. When Nona was there, she had a little room in the back of the house for herself, for her, as her little apartment. And as the story goes, and I wish my mother were still with us, bless her soul, or my dad, they could fill in the gap, but I'm told that I spoke pretty fluent Italian until I was about 5 or 6 years old, which was about the time that Nona went back to, went to live with Dad's brother, Mariano, whose widow is still alive and will help us with the family genealogy. Once Nona left the house, then everybody reverted to English. And as we say laughingly, my brother and sister and I say, we reverted to English except in those instances where mother and dad didn't want us to understand something. Then they could speak their Italian, which I might say was sort of a pidgin Italian, a patois, because Dad spoke this northern Italian, which was a very guttural sort of clip. Somewhat dramatic, because after all, the Austrians and the Austro-Hungarian Empire had owned and taken over northern Italy quite a bit. So there was a certain remnant of that type of language pattern in Dad's Italian. Mother's Italian was Sicilian, which is more undulating, and it sort of laps the sea. It has this sort of sing-song quality to it. But they developed some kind of an Italian they could both understand. It was that Italian that they spoke when we didn't, when we were not to know something that they were speaking to one another.
What brought your dad and your granddad to Louisville specifically?
We'll talk about that at more length. In fact, we had a meeting with my aunt and my cousin just within a week from the time this interview is being done, in which they produced an awful lot of papers they had gleaned from safety deposit boxes, from doing work in genealogical websites, and from Ellis Island records. But what brought them here, as I can understand from a letter, was the lack of jobs in Italy. It's very interesting. There's a letter which we'll put in the archives, a very plaintive kind of letter from my grandfather to Romano Romano Rosa, who, along with his brother Gioacchino, or in American they called it Kino, but Gioacchino Rosa and Romano Rosa emigrated to the U.S., first to Vermont, then to St. Louis, then to Louisville, always within the trade of tile, marble, terrazzo, mosaic. And there was a letter that my aunt uncovered from my grandfather to Romano Rosa, who by that time was a very prosperous member of the Louisville community, very, very well-to-do, from his business of tile as well as real estate, asking if there was some way that they could get to the United States because jobs were drying up. And it is eerie how similar that pattern of writing and the story it told is to today.
Mm-hmm.
Of people who are needing jobs and have to move sometimes even across oceans, not just across rivers, but across oceans to get those jobs.
Right.
And so it's going to be very revelatory, I think, for the purpose of our family of how they got here. But once they got here, which was October of 1914, within 3 months, December of 1914, my grandfather died. We even have some records of the medical doctors of what they were giving him and treating him over this infection, which obviously today would be treated in a minute with some penicillin type or some antibiotic. But in those days, it was a fatal. But it was interesting to read this, and we'll go into it. But one of the foodstuffs that my grandfather was eating was egg and whiskey. Now, it sounds pretty weird to have egg and whiskey, but I remember when my own father was ill. He was ill several times in his lifetime, and he couldn't hold food down. He would crack an egg into Italian bitters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all people, probably the Irish have a sort of bitters.
Mm-hmm.
Grappa, the mm-hmm. Greeks have it, the Syrians have it. So he would take an egg and drop it into the bitters and then swallow the whole thing down because he couldn't hold food. So it was kind of interesting when I read the medical report of my grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
That they had egg and whiskey, that years and years and years later, my dad had egg and bitters. So somehow that technology, while seemingly pretty rudimentary, seemed to have some medical beneficial effect.
Mm-hmm.
But my grandfather died in December, and my father continued happily to live in Louisville, though it was a rocky situation because his mother was still in Europe and his brothers and sisters were there, and so he just had the Rosa family, and it wasn't always an easy relationship. From there, we moved to from Jagger Avenue and the influence of the Rosas. I might say, without getting into too many details, that my father's impression always had been that he would be invited into the company. He
mm-hmm.
had done a lot of work and traveled the country for the company and done wonderful work. He didn't really himself have much education, not even a grade school diploma, but a very bright guy, and his impression was he'd be invited into the business
mm-hmm.
as a partner, as a co-owner. Well, they the Rosas, by that time the Rosa brothers themselves couldn't get along, so they broke up into two separate companies. But the one Rosa that Dad had stayed with, Romano, more or less said, you not only aren't going to be part of the business, but you're also not going to stay in that house on Jagger Avenue because we own it.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to quickly find something, went down to Tyler Park Drive, Tyler Park Way, where Dad had to start a business. He had to provide for the three of us and for Mother. So,
about what time is this?
That would have been probably 1940. I'll get that from my sister, but that's about the time, toward the end of the
decade. So you're about 7 or 8 years old at that time, and you're already in grade school.
Right.
Okay.
And we were in grade school at St. James, so that was just up the street, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But Dad had to start a business, and so he had, there was a garage in the back of this house we rented on Tyler Parkway, and that was the place he used for his shop
mm-hmm.
to store materials and that type of thing. And the truck happened to be our 1938 Chevrolet. Of course, if you remember, you're too young to remember, but cars were not made during the war years. They made Jeeps and they made trucks for war fighting, but they didn't make passenger cars. So these cars that were in existence in the 30s had to survive until after the war when they started making cars. So anyway, Dad somehow retrofitted this 1938 Chevrolet by taking seats out and putting pieces of plywood in to make it into a makeshift truck. And it was that truck that delivered us kids over to St. James School.
Okay.
We were not happy campers about it. Piling out of a thing with cement bags around and so forth is not what most of the kids were doing, who were our peers, but we did it. But anyway, Dad and Mother continued to provide a living for us on Tyler Park. We were there not very long, but then we moved over to Ardmore Drive, where 939 Ardmore Drive, it was then a street called Phillips Avenue, but they renamed it Ardmore Drive later to prevent confusion with Phillips Lane, which is out there by the fairgrounds.
And how old were you at that time?
Well, it was in 1941, so I would have been 9 years old.
And that wouldn't require a change in school.
We continue to go back to, we were in another zone, if you want to call the parochial schools, though. They didn't have a rigid zone, so we were in another school area, another parish, but we continue to go back to St. James to finish up our grade school. Three of us finished up there. But Ardmore Drive, and as the story goes, Mother and Dad had what was called, in today's term, sweat equity. Mm-hmm. They offered a fellow named George Kelly, who was the builder of these homes in this little area. It's we're near the current St. X. It's just off a Poplar Level Road, south of south of Eastern Parkway. But anyway, they found this builder who needed to be able to have tile work done in these homes he was building. And the tile work consisted of the facings and the floor of the mantle, the backsplashes and drain board for the sinks in the kitchen, and a small bathroom, 5x8 bathroom, with a tile up over the shower stall, up over the tub. And so as I understand it, and once again, my sister can probably fill in more of the details, and they did several houses in the neighborhood, and in return for the money they did for the tile work, that was a down payment on their home. So 939 Ardmore was bought literally by the sweat and hard work of my mother and Dad, Mother keeping the books and trying to collect the bills and doing all that sort of thing, and Dad primarily doing the outside work, the actual installation of it, and the hiring of the men and running of the shop.
Now, was that was your official residence for all the years you were in Congress, too?
It was.
It was.
Well, and what I take it back, and I need to mention, 939 was where all of us grew up. Mm-hmm. And in those days, when guys became majority, they didn't move and find their own apartments. Nowadays, it's commonplace for kids, once they leave for college, to never go back to the home nest. They get their own apartment or that type of thing. Well, for us, we stayed in the house until we got married. So I got married in 1959 to Helen, and we rented an apartment on Eastern Parkway in Crittenden Drive, which amounted to my last year of law school. And I'll fill in the gap between Ardmore Drive and law school soon, but had the situation of living on Ardmore Drive 939 from 1941 until 1959. That was my time at 939. We then, like I say, got married, and then Helen and I moved over to Crittenden Drive. We were there for 5 years. That took us to 1963. And the kids came, and we didn't have room in this little apartment, so we looked right next door to 939 Ardmore Drive. It was an empty lot. My mother and dad had bought it sometime in the early 1940s for like $1,500 from a fellow, Marion Johnson. Why I would remember his name, I don't know, but anyway, Marion Johnson. And it was in that lot, 50 by 150 feet long, that a couple of things occurred. One, it became a playground for the neighborhood, for all of us. My dad put in a kind of a makeshift backboard for basketball. We used the mud for the floor of the basketball court, so it means, you know, you didn't have a steady bounce of the ball. There was a big mulberry tree in the front part of the lot, which we used to play Tarzan and to, you know, climb the tree and swing out of it with monkey vines and crazy stuff that kids do. And in the far back of it was where Dad put in holding bins for his sand and the gravel that he needed for his work, because once again he worked out of the garages at 939 Ardmore Drive, as he had worked out of the garages on Tyler Parkway. So those were the things that occurred at 937. But when the kids came in 1960, well, Mike was born in 1960 and Andrea in 1963, we needed someplace. So we built a home on that empty lot, which had been our neighborhood playground and been part of my dad's shop. By that time, he had moved the business arrangement over to Manoma Avenue, which is very nearby, and built his own place, concrete block business. It's still there, beautiful as ever. It's now owned by an architect, Michael Cook, whose dad and I were classmates at St. X. And Michael said when he moved in, it was so beautiful that he never did do anything to take some of the tile and marble and terrazzo work out of it. He remodeled the whole place, had to, because for the most part, this building was just a shed to house the material.
As but a boy Michael, growing up, did you do similar work with your dad?
Absolutely.
Tile work and laboring, or did you actually learn the techniques of setting tile?
I never did learn the technique of setting. I was never an installer. That was really more talent than I had, more mechanical skill than I possessed. But my brother Richard did that and did it very admirably. He was quite a mechanic, and when Dad passed away, Rich ran the business for a few years and with Mother's help, and it didn't really work out. Dad was sort of the centerpiece, but Rich indeed went on the job and he could help. But all of us in the summertime, including my sister Trish, who actually ran the office after Mother decided that she didn't want to work there anymore, we all worked in the summertime. I remember vividly Mother putting together lunch for us. That was before the days of these porta potties, where you just really had to go all day long, basically. It was before the days of child labor and hard hats and OSHA and things like that, Occupational Safety Health Administration rules and regulations for workplace safety. So I mean, it was pretty dangerous, because we would ride in the back of the truck to the job, and then we'd work and carry sand and gravel, and we'd carry cement buckets, and we would use the hoe. No cement mixers like you have now. The cement was, and the water and lime and stuff was put into the mortar box, which was a shallow box about 5 or 6 feet long, and then you would cut, as they say, cut the mud by running your hoe, which had two holes in it, and it was almost like extruding the stuff. But you'd run that hole through it from one side, then you'd switch sides and run it back the other way. You've probably maybe seen some of that at the Cape, where some people went. In fact, you may have done something like that your very self, Kevin, where you hand mix the mortar. So that's what Dad, that's what we did, Rich and I. So we really got an early indoctrination into what immensely hard work it was to do and what sacrifices Mother and Dad made for us. That we were able to capitalize on by reason of having our education. We were able to move forward in the world because of their sacrifice, because they were willing to do that for us. So I've always, every day, thank Mother and Dad for what they did. I'm sure Rich and Trish do the same thing, that it just was a labor of love, everything they did for us. But we moved in 1963 to 939 Ardmore, where we were until my election to Congress. From 71 to 73, as I may have mentioned, we stayed in that house. I commuted to Washington for the first 2.5 years of my congressional career. And then after that, I didn't like that idea. Weekends were not spent with the family. They were out doing campaigning or constituent work. So in 1973, we bought a home in Alexandria, Virginia, a home whose main recommendation was it was a home we could afford. It wasn't stylish, but it was very well built. It was a happy, wonderful, memorable home for our kids to live in and grow up in, basically, though they started their schooling in Louisville at Mother Sorrow's, and we're both baptized here.
Well, we'll do some more conversation about your family, and we'll be interviewing folks in your family, so we can cover some more of this at a later date. Two general questions about your impressions about the city of Louisville, because in the days when you were growing up as a young man, the city of Louisville would have been a segregated city. Were you conscious of that, and you know, how did that play into your general experience of growing up in Louisville?
Kevin, I really wish that I could say that it affected me in a way that I was very conscious of it, that I was aghast at it, repelled by it, but I can't say that in truth.
Mm-hmm.
We were part of that growing up process. It was, unfortunately, I guess you'd say it was the norm. It was the way things were. I wish I could say that I wanted to change the way things were, but I didn't. As to whether or not it affected my work later, I think maybe because I got into immigration work in Congress, and of course my dad was an immigrant himself, and that's probably predisposed me a little bit. But I like to think that possibly when I see in my father and see in my uncle and my aunt, who's still alive, the way immigrants have added to our community, it may have been that when I saw that some people could have added to the community but weren't permitted to do so because of segregation, then I may have tried in a conscious way or maybe an unconscious way to right some of those grievances. But in candor, I can't say that in those days I had any amazing feeling about it. I will say this, my mother had frail health and she had to have household help. And even on Tyler Parkway, which would have been in the late 30s. And there was a young black woman by the name of Louise Van Meter, whose husband worked with my father, but Louise Van Meter came to work for my mother and for us. She was sort of like a nanny as well. We were, in the late 30s, I would have been 7 or 8 years old, Rich 4, Trish 2 or 3. And mother, who just was a wonderful, wonderful person to everybody, always treated Louise as a member of the family. Now, that didn't mean that we went to Louise's home, though in later years we did. We met her mother, and mother and Louise became closest of friends. But I will say that we treated mother treated Louise with the utmost respect, and they actually became great friends. So in any event, once again, it wasn't that we took some steps, dramatic steps or otherwise, to right the wrong of segregation. But I think as far as living out, we didn't attempt to demean people or to ridicule them or to finger point at them because they were different skin color or things like that. But I believe later in life, through the immigration work and the many bills, you know, Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Acts that I voted for and supported, the situation, which I may not have seen so much as a kid to be difficult and unfair, was addressed in my years when I was in I remember also when I was a state senator, the very first bill that we had, I'll never forget this because it became quite controversial. There was an effort in 1968 in the state senate to revive what would amount to the Un-American Activities Committee, which you remember from your study of Washington was a very major situation. And that, of course, was addressed at a lot of people, including black people, African Americans. And Georgia Davis, now Georgia Davis Powers, then senator, first black senator and the first female black senator, and I were the only two people in the Kentucky State Senate to vote against the reconstitution of the constitution of a Kentucky
Un-American Activities
Committee.
Yeah,
Un-American. Thank you very much. The Kentucky Un-American Activities Committee, a la the Washington side. So it may have been even by that time. I mean, again, I hadn't taken part in any kind of marches. But by the time I got to the state Senate, which was in the 60s, I certainly felt that there was no need to further develop these themes of discrimination and of segregation and of separatives, of separation. And I think that would that vote sort of vivified that.
Let me ask you two other questions, general questions about your impressions of Louisville. One, as a young man growing up in Louisville, were you conscious of the ethnicity of different neighborhoods? Were they, was there an Italian section in Louisville, and was there a Polish section and an Irish section and so forth? And would you have noticed that growing up, and would you have impressions of the different areas?
It's an excellent question. I don't think I noticed it growing up, but it's pretty evident from any of the readings that I've done that Louisville was indeed a city in which the ethnic groups, such as they were then, were sort of isolated. And, of course, we talked before, if you want to say ethnic groups, the African-Americans were primarily in. It wasn't even the West End at that time, because the West End was primarily Irish. The North End, which is the area about around the Ohio River, was primarily Irish. The area around what's called now the Nucleus area, which was the old Haymarket, where the farmers literally had the farmer's market, but an extensive array of buildings down there on Main and Market Street, primarily Syrian and Lebanese. Around where Helen grew up in Germantown, it was Germans and so forth. The Highlands was a mixture of mostly, but the biggest ethnic groups were Irish and German, and there was not a significant Italian population. What there was of it was sort of coalesced around the old Haymarket down there in the downtown area, along with the Syrians and the Lebanese and the Jewish people. That was all that sort of their enclave. Of course, now, and I take part steadily in these events, I just spoke to the Hispanic-Latino Coalition at the Muhammad Ali Center, and I have taken part in many naturalization ceremonies. I hope to take part in another one in June the 11th, a few days from where we're now talking. And so you see the coming together of all kinds of people from 50, 60 countries of the world. In those days, Kevin, there was not that type of diversity. But parishes, you'd have two or three Catholic churches side by side. One served the Irish, one served the German, one served, there was a parish in downtown in the Haymarket area that served the Italian community. The priest, his name was Othman, which is a German name, but coming from northern Italy, a lot of Germanic names are there from totally Italian people. So Father Othman was the pastor of, it was called then St. Michael's Church, and it was in the Haymarket, and that's where the Italians went. So there was definite ethnicity in the church arrangement. I can't speak to the Protestant churches at all. Mm-hmm. Some of them may have been broken down by the ethnic situation, but the Catholic churches definitely served different communities, and you'd have these peculiar arrangement of parishes side by side almost, where they would be very different in their parishioner structure.
Let me ask you one question that reminds me of my dad, actually, something my dad told me back in the city where I grew up in. But you were a young man, not quite a teenager, through all of World War II. Did your dad tell you, or did you ever know of the circumstances, since you're from an Italian heritage, where officials, FBI, police, would check on people of Italian and German heritage to ask questions? My dad had a very good friend, for instance, who was German, and at one point the FBI would come and just talk to the neighbors and to gather general information for purposes of security, I presume. Were you ever aware of anything like that in terms of being Italian?
Or I really cannot say. I don't have any awareness of it. I can't say that it didn't happen, but you know, typically speaking, the immigrants of that era, unlike the immigrants of today, who basically keep one foot in both countries, the country of origin and the country now they're living in, it's not at all uncommon in New York City, particularly the Dominicans, you know, go back to the Dominican Republic and live in New York and go back and forth. In those days, when they got to America, they pretty much cut off their home country. So if my father were interviewed, if my uncle now was actually drafted into the American Army, he had served in the Italian Army in Italy when he was a younger man, but then he came, emigrated to the U.S., and he was drafted in the military, because he was younger than my father. My father was too old to be drafted and had children and so forth. But I think my father would not have been prone to tell me if the FBI or if the local constabulary had called him or my mother to ask questions about what you're doing and, you know, you're in effect, check your loyalty. Mm-hmm. We're aware of the Nisei and the situation of the Japanese Americans, many generations living in California and in the West, who were interned. Mm-hmm. And were sent to Wyoming and put into camps, basically. But as to whether or not my mother and dad or any people in the Italian committee were interrogated or checked, even casually, I really cannot say. Maybe my aunt might be able to help us on that score. My sister, too, who was very, very close to Dad, she worked in the shop with him for years and years when Rich and I had gone. I had gone to college and Army and mm-hmm. was married and so forth, and Rich had gone his way. Trish was still there quite a bit, so she absorbed a lot of that we would maybe ask her about.
Well, we'll have another conversation certainly mm-hmm. on your entire Italian heritage, so there'll be plenty of time to talk about that. Let's move on to your educational experiences. Mm-hmm. You went to grade school?
St. James.
At St. James.
Catholic school at Edenside and Bardstown Road.
Got some memories of that experience? Special teachers or circumstances yeah. you?
Well, a couple of quick things pop up. Our pastor, the Right Reverend Monsignor Earl E. Willett, was one of those pastors in the early days of the Archdiocese of Louisville who, when they became pastor, were pastor forever. I don't know how it was in Boston or in Massachusetts, but it was the pattern when you became pastor that you never left except with your toes pointed up. And while you were there as pastor, you were not pastor alone. You were pastor slash potentate or pastor slash prince, which meant that everybody deferred to the pastor. The sisters did. In those days, of course, we had a convent full of sisters. Every grade was taught by a religious woman. The cafeterias were run by religious women. I mean, it was just the whole thing was totally Catholic. But the one impresario of the whole event was the Right Reverend Monsignor Earl E. Willett. And so he, I remember vividly and will always remember, as a man who brooked no nonsense, brooked no backtalk, brooked no exceptions to his rules and regulations. I also remember a bevy of young priests. In those days, you'd have two or three priests in addition to the pastor in a parish. I mean, we were just abundant priests in our community. Of course, we had, but those in the days when, just like the Irish and Massachusetts, they found two ways up out of their problems. One was become a policeman or another politician or a priest. Mm-hmm. Priest, policeman, politician. That's how the Irish moved along in life. That's how the Italians did in certain areas, like in New York City. And so in those days, it was deemed an honor to have one of your boys go to the priesthood. Mm-hmm. And now it's a lot more problematic for people to accept that. And so we had a lot of priests, and I remember they were young and athletic, and we used to play basketball with them in the playground, which was one of these asphalt playgrounds. The other memorable woman, Sister Anastasia, she eventually, after many years of teaching as an Ursuline sister of Mount St. Joseph Ursuline, there are two Ursuline orders. The Ursulines of Louisville on Lexington Road, which had most of the parishes, but then there were a few run by the Ursulines of Mount St. Joseph, which is Owensboro. Most of these were farm girls, and almost all came from Marion County, Washington County, Nelson County, that Catholic triangular area in central Kentucky. which is where the Archdiocese of Louisville began in that area. But anyway, she was then Sister Anastasia. Her name was Jean Mudd, M-U-D-D, came from New Haven, Kentucky, from a very large family, which again was commonplace. Just like Charlie Mattingly's family is a large family. It was commonplace. They were farm families, and they grew a lot of kids like they grew a lot of corn and grew a lot of cows. She and at least two of her sisters became religious sisters. And she came and taught in the fourth grade at St. James and made an impression on me, and we became friends over the years. And then later, Sister left the convent and was married eventually to a fellow named Jack Miller. And we remained friends over the years. And it wasn't very long ago. It was just earlier this year that Jean Miller, Sister Anastasia, in her... Let me see, I'm 77, and Sister was probably no more than 10 years older than we were when she was teaching us. She was still a girl. When she taught fourth graders, she was still literally a girl. But in any event, Sister Jean passed away in her 80s, and I went to the funeral mass and saw several of our St. James classmates there. So it's sort of like the circle began at Edenside, and the circle closed many years later. But she remains a wonderful person. Many pictures of her that I've found as we've gone through our photographic archive, which will be, of course, part of this collection. And so those are the two things. My athletic exploits were very few in life. I did play a lot of tennis, and we'll talk about St. X in a minute. But in those days, I didn't do much. I was not that athletic. But one time, I don't know why, but I remember winning a free throw contest. And don't ask me how. In those days, you...
Basketball free throws.
And that was like, I can't remember the guy who, even when he went to the NBA, was the last of the Mohicans, the last guy to free throws from between his legs. If you remember, there was a guy whose son became also an NBA player, but... In those days, you threw your free throws by just kind of waving the ball between your knees and then up into them. Well, that's what I did, just because we all did. We didn't shoot the one-hand free throws like they do nowadays and have for years. So anyway, I won this free throw contest, and somewhere in a safety deposit box, I have this little round basketball. It's not inscribed or nothing is scratched into it to evidence when this was, but this was my main claim to athletic fame at St. James, was that. The other thing was, when we did play basketball, we played it in a gym that had not been built for much of anything except a place where kids could exercise when the weather was terrible outside. And it wasn't, as I'm looking at this wall here, you probably have about an 8-foot ceiling, maybe, if you have that, in this room in which we're being interviewed. And so any of the kids who played basketball at St. James, not the ones who played basketball at St. Francis or played basketball at St. Agnes or played basketball at St. Bridget, but only the kids who played basketball at St. James had to invent a shot that was low trajectory, because you had to avoid hitting the ceiling. So these things were more like line shots than they were, you know, loops. Mm-hmm. And so when they got to St. X, they had to relearn the whole game of basketball because they had played it in this very constricted area. But I remember that about St. James. And but it was a good school. I remember, too, a situation where my mother and dad had drummed good manners into all of us, and I hope I still have those good manners. But I remember crossing a street, because we walked to school in those days in the early part. Once we left to Ardmore Drive, Dad had to drive us back, or we took the bus, and the Eastern Parkway bus. But I remember seeing one of the sisters coming from the convent, which was, you know, half a block away from St. James School, still there, and I think it's being converted into apartment houses. And I saw this sister coming with one of these wicker baskets. Well, you know, being the little Lord Fauntleroy that I was, and good manners, and Boy Scout, this and that, I went over and said, "Sister, something, could I help you with that basket?" Well, she said, "Oh, sure." So she handed me the basket, and down I went to the ground. I mean, my arm was almost jerked out of the socket. This was a strong woman, and this was a heavy basket. And I laboriously struggled. I halfway walked, halfway dragged this thing. I wasn't going to give up, though. You know, halfway dragged it back to school and then down those steps into the cafeteria. But that was the last time that I volunteered to carry a basket, because I knew that those things were too heavy for me to handle. But I have that was, what, 70 years ago? Who knows? But I mean, it's been etched into my memory bank, trying to help sister and almost losing my arm in the process.
Let's move on to your high school experience. Yeah. Can you give me 5-minute impressions about St. X? Yeah. This is 1950 that you're...
1946 to 1950, graduate okay. 1950. A wonderful school, old, down to 2nd and Broadway, long since demolished, an old mansion that was converted into a school by the Zavarian brothers who had arrived in Louisville in 1864, a little bit earlier. They arrived earlier than that, but they began their ministry of education in 1864. The mansion was a series of rooms that they made into classrooms, a series of different elevations as they added buildings and tacked things onto it. By today's standards, they would have ruled it probably not habitable, certainly not a place where kids could be educated. But it was a wonderful school. We had, once again, like we had at St. James, all brothers, every one of them, Zavarian brother. We had very few lay teachers. These were demanding men. They were like, you know, from the East Coast. Zavarian brothers all came from Boston. They came from the Bronx. They came from Staten Island. They were tough guys, mostly almost all Irish, some Germans thrown in, but very tough guys, but very wonderful teachers. And so we were on a track system. Some of the guys that went to St. X didn't go to college, but the bulk of us did. Wonderful teachers, wonderful men, wonderful friends. I made most of the friends, because all the guys from St. James went to St. X. So, I mean, there was a procession of kids that I had gone to grade school with that became my high school classmates. And because St. James was an excellent school, most of the guys I was there with at St. James wound up in the, what you might call the college prep part of St. X. And so they became my lifelong friends and remain the ones that are still alive, remain my friends today. I remember playing football. I remember playing football on a field at Clay in Kentucky, which was called then Alumni Field. We didn't have a football stadium like they have off of Poplar Level Road. Now they have this fancy college campus there at St. X. We had nothing. We had the tennis court that we had was one that we just put into the pavement in the back of the school. No backboards, nets or nothing or anything like that.
Were you a good student by your own admission, or
I was a good student, Kevin, but it wasn't because I was brilliant. I had some brilliant friends, David Baird, Don Varga, Bart Brown, who came with me. David and Bart came from St. James with me. Donald Dowden, who came with me from St. James to St. X and followed me with me to Notre Dame. These were brilliant kids, bright as they could be. I was smart, but I worked very hard. I was one of these tenacious people. I just really studied hard. I loved to read. My mother and dad sacrificed a lot to get books for me, so I was a reader from the time I was a little guy, and a voracious reader at that. And so I think I had the predisposition to be a good student and the work ethic to be a good student. But so I was pretty near the top of my class. I wasn't the valedictorian, but pretty near the top of my class, and did well and took the Latin and the French and, you know, the courses that trained you better to be in college. The football part was good because my dad was a great football player, as mm-hmm. I mentioned to you in earlier conversations, and he knew the football coach. Ray Baer, a Jewish guy, was a football coach at St. X. Now, that's diversity. It happened that Ray Baer played football at Michigan under, and the name will come to me at some point, one of the great football coaches like Amos Alonzo Stagg and those people, one of the great football coaches. And he was coaching at St. X. And Dad, who was a center when he played at Bonnie Castle Club, and a good one, wanted me to be a center. Well, I wasn't a big guy. Now, you can tell I'm not a big fellow. But Ray acceded to my dad's request that he try me out at center. So instead of being a running back, and I was a pretty speedy kid, and I used to win a lot of foot races, but I wound up playing in the line as a center in a single wing offense, which means that you had to look through your legs and center the ball to the halfbacks or the quarterback or fullback. And I would get tumbled and upended and things like that. So it was not a happy experience, but I did earn my varsity letter, which I was very proud of and still have on a sweater in a closet at home. And a sport that I did know and did do very well in was tennis. And we had played 4 years of varsity tennis. And in my senior year, won the state doubles championship with a friend of mine named George Coper, who still lives. And George was a junior 1 year below, but excellent tennis player, great friend and a good man. And so we won a state championship for St. X. And my coach then was Brother Thomas Moore, who became principal of St. X later, not at that time, but later. And he was also the superior general of the Xaverian Order and was in Rome for several years. An absolutely unique human being. He was brilliant. He was just one of the great thinkers of the Xaverian Order, and they had a lot of very, very intelligent and insightful brothers in that era. But he was our tennis coach and became my friend and stayed my friend. And even when he was in Washington, he was living there with another brother on Capitol Hill, on Michigan Avenue near Capitol Hill, near Catholic University. And so Helen and I went two or three times down to their house, where the brothers, both of them, came from Baltimore, and they're great seafood cooks. And coming from Boston, as you know, seafood is... we used to go down for some great seafood experiences, whatever would be the Irish or the Baltimorean equivalent of paella, mm-hmm. paella,
right.
Which is the Spanish right. stuff where you right. throw everything in there, let it simmer for a couple of days,
yep.
and it tastes great. that's what we would have. So I stay close to Brother Thomas Moore, Brother Lionel.
Right. Let me ask you, in terms of the overall experience at St. X, do you remember or recall any experiences in high school, any teachers, any courses that you took that would steer you or would affect your later on career as a politician?
I don't really think so. I believe the fact that you had to take Latin when you were in that certain area probably prepared me for college in its own way. Just as a little sidebar, Helen and I took a Latin course just this year at Bellarmine in one of these adult education courses. I remembered very little of my original Latin, but it was a good experiment. What I do remember, the demands that the brothers placed on us. I mean, you know, they were no nonsense people. Mm-hmm. These were all men, and we were all men. It was no women in that area, so they were very demanding. So I was pretty well prepared for what lay ahead at Notre Dame simply because of the way they taught me. I can't remember any particular one course or any particular one teacher that may have been one that stuck out. But one incident that I can remember vividly, and I have referred to this many, many times, and that was in our senior year we took what amounted to Christmas baskets of food and Christmas goodies to the people who lived in the public housing projects. And once again, as I mentioned earlier, you lived in a neighborhood. It was a fairly provincial kind of life, insular, if you want to call it that. We didn't have many kids at St. X from the west end of Louisville. They went to Flagey, which is a school no longer in existence. But so we didn't really get that far west of 18th Street. And so here was an experience where we put these baskets together, and then obviously with the help of some chaperone, we would go to the projects and deliver these baskets. Well, that was, if that was in 1950, that would have been, 1950 would have been 50, almost 60 years ago, mm-hmm. and I would have been maybe 16, 17, mm-hmm. 60 years ago, a vivid memory. None of the rest of it can I remember. Mm-hmm. 60 years vanishes. Mm-hmm. Some of my friends I get together with, my classmates, some of those guys have absolutely perfect pitch memory. Remember everything.
Yeah.
I remember nothing, but that I remember. And I use that as an experience of how vivid it is to do something for somebody else, how important it is, because doing something for us, for ourselves, is not only not the way life should be lived, but it's also not anything you're going to remember very long. It doesn't mm-hmm. bring you that sense of fulfillment or satisfaction. But that experience of, for the first time in my life, going into areas where people were truly in need. Now, we lived a modest life, never took a vacation in our entire life. No vacations on Jagger Avenue, no vacations on Ardmore Drive. There was no such thing as a vacation for the Mazzoli family. It was all work, summertime, wintertime, whatever. But we were never in need. My mother and dad were hard workers. They were provident. They didn't waste money. We always had food on the table. We had clothes that we needed. This was the first time in my life that I had really confronted directly people who did not have the food, who didn't have the clothes, who didn't have the sustenance that we had, that we took for granted.
Right.
And it stayed with me forever. And if there was anything that sort of predisposed me for thinking in terms of doing something that would allow me to help other people, and I did consider the priesthood at different parts, that would have been a way to do it. Mm-hmm. I considered a medical profession because we had a wonderful doctor, Dr. Arch Herzer, who when we were on Jagger Avenue used to make house calls. And you're too young to remember, but he used to carry a little vial of sugar pills. And he'd come to, because mother and dad had illnesses in their lifetime. Happily, we didn't as kids. But Dr. Arch Herzer would come over, and then he'd take care of mother and dad, whatever it was. Then he'd say, they called me Ronnie then. Ronnie, come over here. And he said, are you feeling okay? I said, well, you know, doctor, So he'd give me a little sugar pill, and I'd take that sugar pill. Well, I wanted to be a doctor because of Dr. Herzer. I wanted mm-hmm. to be a priest because of Father Robin, Father Aloysius Robin. Good-looking, tall, Irish guy who was a priest at our church. When he was in those vestments at Easter time, I mean, you had to fall in love with the guy and fall in love with his profession.
Mm-hmm.
Those didn't turn out at different stages of my life, but the one thing that did was political life. So it could very well have been that in those days, I was thinking about it somehow. Is that one avenue to help people?
Mm-hmm.
I'm told, and this is a little bit backward, but I'm told while I really got started with politics, and we'll talk about this later with John Kennedy and the advent of John Kennedy on the national and international scene, I'm told that when every year they crowned the Queen of the May mm-hmm. at St. James, and that girl had a chance to bring the crown up to the Blessed Virgin. So during May, the Virgin had a crown on her head. And the bearer of the crown was selected by the student body. So I'm told that I actually went around and must have done some political hustling for my sister, Patricia. And somehow, it must have been decently successful because Patricia was deemed the one to bring the crown up to the Blessed Virgin Mary statue as Queen of the May.
Mm-hmm.
So any event, so those were maybe early elements that later coalesced into something that moved me into the political career. But I never forget that experience of carrying food baskets.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember St. X with a warm feeling because lifelong friendships were formed there.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved the brothers, and they were tough. I loved them. I loved my classmates, and the ones that are still alive, we continue to get together.
Let me ask you, so when you graduate from St. X, you move on to Notre Dame. How did you choose Notre Dame?
Well, I think that it was chosen in a way for me and by me, both ways. For me, because of Notre Dame football, and I know that around the Boston area, BC does good things on the. Well, I feel the same way too, but I won't tell it to our adoring public. But, in the 1940s, radio. My dad, as I mentioned, was a great football player. Well, he loved football and he played it, And he loved Notre Dame because I've said before that Notre Dame was more or less the Harvard for the immigrants. I mean, it was a school that people who were Poles and Slovaks and Eastern Europeans, you know, and Italians, Southern Europeans could go. And that was the epitome of schools for that group of people, that immigrant community. And it happened that the football teams that Notre Dame put on the field back when Frank Leahy was a coach in the early 1940s, who had come happily and pulled him away from Boston College. And from that point on, he used to beat Boston College, which we were very happy about. Those football games were broadcast on radio. And Dad and I used to listen to them avidly. I mean, just immersed in them. And then later, in my high school years, they used to run a train from Union Station, 9th and Broadway, a train up to South Bend for a football game. You go up in the early morning, you get to South Bend, watch a ball game, come back that same day, and you're back in before the day has ended. So I just fell in love with Notre Dame. I fell in love with the campus. I fell in love with the mystique of the place, the Golden Dome.
Did you ever consider any other university?
Never. I don't know what would happen.
What did you major in at Notre Dame?
Well, it's a very good question. I majored in business. The thought process was, and we'll get to my Army years eventually, which were the years that really turned me into my ultimate career of law and then politics. But the plan was for me to earn my degree at Notre Dame in business and then come back and work with Dad, you know, the idea being that I could be part of a new generation to help Dad. And so that was my degree. As it turned out, and probably also a little inkling of what lay ahead for me was the fact that when I had electives to take, I never took them in the business field. And I wasn't a scientist, so the idea of anything that deals with numbers or, you know, scientific concepts was out. I used to take them in English or in literature, the humanities, the liberal arts. So that was really where my focus was. And though I never did take a political science course, that, of course, is where political science fits in the arts and sciences. And so the reality of it was that while business was the degree that I had, and I earned it with magna cum laude, so I did well in the studies, my eyes were always averted. My eyes were looking somewhere else. I wasn't sure where. It wasn't until the Army that I realized where my eyes were gazing, but they were not gazing on business. But the idea was Notre Dame was a wonderful place. First time at St. X was the first time that I had seen kids from a broader community than the Highlands, because St. James drew just from the Highlands. St. X drew from a larger part of the city, didn't draw from the West End, but it did draw from a larger part of the city, South End and farther parts of the East End. Notre Dame, wow, it drew from 50 states. It drew from foreign countries. I mean, was that an eye-opener for Ron Mazzoli, a very insular kind of guy, you know, pretty provincial fellow, had read a lot, had read about all these places, and had, in my dreams, gone there, but never been there. Well, these men, then Notre Dame was all male, were my tickets to live a different life. And so Notre Dame was a most important developmental experience for me. If I had not gone to Notre Dame, if I'd gone to U of L, I would have probably been a good student and gotten a good education. But I would have been rubbing shoulders with the very same people I'd rubbed shoulders with for all the years theretofore. Mm-hmm. In Notre Dame, I was rubbing shoulders with men I would never have met otherwise. And not to say that if I'd gone to Harvard or one of the Ivy League schools, or if I'd gone to Dayton or gone to some other school, that Xavier, for example, or one of the Loyolas, I might have had the same experience. But Notre Dame was, for all those many reasons, my boyhood dream centered on Notre Dame, and it was just exactly what I needed. It was exactly what I needed and wanted and was nurtured by, and it's remained a force of influence. I met Father Hesburgh there, and then Father Hesburgh remained, as you know from reading about my immigration.
Was he a student at the time, or was
Father
he
was
teaching?
He was a young Holy Cross priest. He became a president when he was only 35 years old. When I got on campus in 1950, he was what was called the chaplain to Vetville. There was a broad swath of the campus, which is now with beautiful buildings. In those days, it was just a sort of a flat stretch of Quonset hut-type buildings, temporary-type buildings, built during the war to house Notre Dame had a V-12 program where the Navy students came to study. And parenthetically, some will say that the Navy is what kept Notre Dame in business, because without the Navy students, Notre Dame would have probably collapsed. However true that is, I don't know. But I do know that Notre Dame continues to play Navy in football, and it's I believe, the longest unbroken stretch of intercollegiate football. And people say, why do you play Navy? Though Navy has beaten Notre Dame a couple of times in recent years, which hasn't been pleasant. But we beat, except for Roger Staubach, going back to that era, we beat Navy regularly. You say, why keep them on the schedule? Well, they say that they did because there was a debt that Notre Dame continued to pay the Navy. But that group of beat-up buildings was where the veterans came back in the 1950s after the war,
mm-hmm.
lived with their families, and it was called Vetville. And Father Hesburgh was the chaplain to Vetville. And that's where we all knew him, as a young, extraordinarily good-looking man with extraordinary talents. And it wasn't long before the Holy Cross Fathers deemed him to be the guy that should be the president to follow Hugh Cavanaugh. So he became president of Notre Dame in 1952, my sophomore year, and was president for the next 35 years, which took him through my early years in Congress, through my middle and later years in Congress, through the immigration bill, and we'll mm-hmm. talk about that in due course, as a most important shaper of the immigration bill, which continues to be on the books, known as Simpson-Mazzoli, but more formally as the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986. But anyway, Notre Dame was where I met Father Hesburgh and his friend and ally, Father Ned Joyce. The two of them were allies and young priests together, and one became president and one became the executive vice president. They both propelled Notre Dame from a good school to a great school in those years. And it was my good fortune to have been there as Notre Dame made the turn from the good school into a school about to be deemed a great school, as it is today, one of the top schools in the nation. And so I was on campus for that, and still go back to Notre Dame events. I served on the alumni board. We had what were called, Helen and I would call, our golden years, which were the years from 1981 to 1986. And that's when our two children, Michael and Andrew, were students at Notre Dame. And when I was a member of the alumni board at Notre Dame, and in 1985, the year that Andrea and her future husband, Martin Doyle, were graduating, I was awarded an honorary degree. And due to Father Hesburgh and the fact that we were working on immigration for all those years, and he thought that was an important issue to be identified with Notre Dame and with a person whose career pretty much centered around that.
What year was the honorary degree?
1985. And my earned degree was 1954, but my honorary is 1985. And it was, you can imagine how emotional, because I'm looking out at this sea of faces, and Andrea and Martin are there. So we celebrate 1985 as a pretty special year. The kids got married the year later, mm-hmm. in 1986, but in 1985 they both graduated. I was with Martin just this morning at an event for our granddaughter, Courtney, their second of their two girls, who's an aspiring actress, and so we were at a fundraising event for Walden School, Walden Theater, which mm-hmm. is where she attends.
So you graduate from Notre Dame in 1954, And the next task in front of you is military service. Did you enlist or were you drafted? Or
let me go back one very quick thing. I was drafted. Go back to Notre Dame for one thing. Notre Dame is known for a lot of reasons, for its spirituality, for its dedication to the Blessed Virgin, for its lengthy history. 1846 is when it was founded, in the middle of the barrens of northern Indiana, the windswept, cold area of northern Indiana. It's also known for its residentiality. Notre Dame has always been a residential campus, and this is the same way at Harvard and Yale and some of the other Ivies. It's when you go on campus, you never leave campus. 4 years you spend in some hall, some dorm, someplace. And if there's anything that left a hallmark on me, along with a good education at Notre Dame and friendships with people like Father Hesburgh, is a residential character. When you're living with men in those days, you're living in the closest of situations where you become brothers. You have this band of brothers. You can't be closer than to those. You can't. The affiliation was as close as a blood affiliation, and that has stayed with me the whole time. I think that also planted some seeds in my head about doing something with my life that would allow me to be part of a larger setting. And that's what Notre Dame, we broke down into halls, a couple of hundred guys probably living in a hall. But then there was a broader community. So I think the same way the politics, it's a small constituency, but you have a broader opportunity to help. But I graduated and probably late May or June of 1954, came home. In the meantime, the Korean War, of course, had broken out, and some of the guys were actually drafted from the campus, and some of them actually were taken away from campus and didn't have a chance to graduate with their class. In my case, I graduated with the class, but within, I believe, 30 days or 45 days, I was standing tall at Fort Knox as part of the U.S. Army. Not willingly at all. I had not wanted to do that, but it became one of the transformative experiences of my life. For one thing, there was another element of, now I had been moved to a larger stage from St. James going to St. X, St. X going to Notre Dame. But talk about a broader stage still, was the U.S. Army, where, get back to the idea of a segregated community that I lived in. Mm-hmm. Realistically, St. X was primarily white. We had a couple of black students, not many. Notre Dame was primarily white. We had black students, but not a lot of them. You get into the Army, of course, President Truman had desegregated the Army many years earlier. So you're in the barracks, and I'm talking about no cubicles, no privacy. I mean, you're talking about an open shower stall area. You're talking about open latrine areas, open barracks, the living area, the sleeping area, with guys that you never would have ever been with before in your life. And that was also a wonderful transformative experience for me, to just be with guys and say, well, you know, I never lived with a black guy before. I'd never had that experience. I'd never lived with a guy from West Virginia, who was just a high school guy. We were college graduates by that time. So this was a place where I once again learned a lot about people and about myself. You know, how could I function? I wasn't, as I mentioned before, all that greatly athletic. I wasn't a warrior type by nature, but I learned how to field strip a weapon. I learned how to put that baby together under a blanket where I couldn't see the parts, but I have to feel them. Mm-hmm. I learned how to polish a boot until it could be used as a mirror. I learned how to press and learned how to sew and learned how to march. I learned how to do pull-ups and all. Anyway, so it was teaching Ron Mazzoli some really interesting lessons. But
all of this is at Fort Knox?
Well, not all of it, but that was a part of it. That was your first eight, your basic training. Okay. Teach you how to be a soldier, how to march, how to clean a weapon, how to break a weapon down, put it together. Right. Again, how to shoot it. how to handle the basic skills you have to have to be a soldier.
Right.
Then they moved you to another 8-week program, depending on what you want. Sometimes you became a cook, sometimes you became a truck driver or a mechanic. Sometimes, like in my case, they sent me to Fort Benjamin Harrison, after basic training of 8 weeks, there was like a second 8 where they, at Fort Knox, where they taught you basic office skills, typing, filing, things like that, pretty basic stuff, nothing big time. But I think they took those of us who had been to college and probably moved us somewhat into that category. So you had the first 8 of basic training, second 8 of a little more specialized, and then for those of us, I guess, who may have done pretty well there, they sent us to, for 6 months, to Fort Benjamin Harrison in Indianapolis at that time to learn to become stenographers. And that's at the Greg shorthand. Now, as a stenographer, you could have been sent to any place to become the amanuensis for a general and sat there all day long taking letters and doing morning reports and, you know, going slowly nuts. Or, as in my case, after I finished Benjamin Harrison and did very well, like I did at Notre Dame. I mean, I was a hardworking student, learned shorthand, studied it carefully. They sent me to Alaska to basically do reports of courts-martial proceedings. Now, not the general, which is where if a soldier does really a terrible misdeed, you could lose your life. But in the summary and special, the lower two categories, where you have soldiers doing, you know, misdemeanors and sort of lesser offenses. And there had to be somebody to take the transcript so that, you know, some military judge could read the transcript and say, did they rule correctly in giving this guy 30 days in the brig or dropping him one pay rank or something like that.
So like a court reporter.
It was a court reporter. I was a court reporter and courts martial. That's right. And so I spent the year in Alaska at Fort Benjamin Harrison doing a courts martial, listening to law, being around military lawyers, transcribing those cases, looking into briefing books, studying the Uniform Code of Military Justice to see, you know, because they were referred to certain code references. And to quickly move the story forward, when I got back home to Louisville, and of course, still it was expected that I would work with my father and in the business using my degree from Notre Dame. I would have a 2-year absence because of the Army, but that would be the plan. But when I got back home, not far from U of L, because my dad's shop was within just a couple of minutes, 4 or 5 minutes from the university's campus, the Belknap campus, I had been around the law, and there was such a thing called law school. So I said, well, maybe I could apply for law school. So I did. And in 1957, I got out of the Army in 56. Was there from 54 to 56. Got out of the Army in 56 and then spent a year working with Dad while I was getting myself sort of organized in my thinking. And then entered law school in 57 and then graduated in 1960. I would not have gone to law school, Kevin, had I not had that Army experience. So It taught me, it moved me into my career. Like I was saying before a little bit, when I was at Notre Dame, my gaze was not on the business world. And probably when I worked with my father that 1 year after the Army, my gaze would probably not on the business. I wish it had been. I wish I had really been able to help Dad better than I did. I felt bad about that later.
He must have been very proud of you and your career. Huh?
Well, he was, Kevin, and that made up for it. And sure. I want to tell an incident when I was in the state Senate. That's yet ahead, but involving my father. But in any event, the Army was what then allowed me to say, this is really what I want to do. I think the law is really something important. And so I graduated in 1960, and then Helen and I married in 1959, and we lived in this little apartment house until, as I mentioned before, The kids came. Then we moved to 937 Ardmore Drive. But the But the experience of law school was very important. Once again, met a lot of friends and did very well.
Any influential professors while you were at U of L or particular courses with an eye towards what your eventual career is going to be? I mean,
the
that
other
would
day
have
I was asked,
I
got out of law school 50 years ago, and so they had a 50-year reunion just last week, and I was designated to carry out, along with Charlie Oberst, who's a medical doctor, also 50 years out of medical school. The two of us presented this check for $3 million, actually, to the University of Louisville, which was the class gift, the class of 1960. Engineering school, medical school, law school, undergraduate programs, the whole bit. And I was asked as part of that to remember a little bit about law school. And the only thing I could remember about law school was how damn tough future interests were and taxation. I had to take those two courses to graduate, and they were terrible. So the only things I can remember, not the courses I did well in, but I wound up first in the class. I must have done decently well. But the ones that I did absolutely abysmally, and then those were the two of them. The other thing I remember are some memorable professors. Our dean was Absalom Russell. And I think there was a great book, I've forgotten who was it, Absalom, My Son. It was a great, it's a great biblical name. But Ab Russell was one of these fellows who lived in aphorisms. He had one for every occasion. He was always talking about you have to have a peg to hang your hat on. You got to give the jury and the court and the panel, if there's a panel of jurists, give them a peg to hang their hat on, which means give them a fact, give them a law, give them a citation, a reference, and then they can hang their hat on it and give you the verdict. And he was also saying about, you know, going up the gum stump, I guess in the country where he came from, and he wasn't, I don't think he was from Kentucky. I think he was from one of the southern states. He had this wonderful southern melodious accent, but talking about going up the gum stump, which is, to, you know, chasing something, and you go, you put them up on the gum stump, and they can't get away. You got them sort of isolated or cornered. And I remember Larry Knowles, who taught future interest, which just devastated me, but it turned out, probably fittingly enough, that Larry and I became colleagues when I joined the U of L, the Brandeis School of Law, as a faculty member. He was still on the faculty. So here's this young guy. He must have been just a kid. He just, I think he went to Rutgers Law School. I know he came from New Jersey. And I think that Larry must have been probably still in his 20s when he had us, because, you know, when he taught us his future interest thing. And so anyway, I used to tell Larry, I said, he had many wonderful and peculiar talents. I think the term is oenophile, who a person who understands wine is a real connoisseur. I mean, understands wine, how you make it, how you savor it, how you drink it. And he's an oenophile. And he's also, I think it was called a terra, he was a, I'll get the word, but it's like terramachus, which is a term for a person who loves bullfighting. He goes to Spain. He's still alive, bless his soul. And he got a place in Costa Rica, which is where he mostly lives. But in any event, I think it's Terramachia, but it has something to do, the root word is with bulls and bullfighting. And so I always said, in addition to future interest, which I was above my pay grade, I said, you also know wine, you know bullfighting. I said, you're a man for all seasons. But anyway, Larry Knowles, a good guy. But as for courses that directed me into politics, no, I will say this. There was one of my friends, in those days you didn't have the bar prep courses. Two things prepared me for the bar. One was Judge Lawrence Grauman, who taught trial practice in our senior year. And Lawrence Grauman really was not teaching trial practice. He was teaching a bar prep course. He was synthesizing these 3 years of separate studies and different torts and property and this and that, and pulling them together as a body of law. And then the bar examiners would, of course, put questions together. And when I went to Frankfurt to take the bar exam, I told Judge Grauman many times thereafter, I actually saw his face, and he had a very distinctive voice. I saw your face and that distinctive voice coming up out of the blue book that we had to take the exam in. And so it was, he was an influence on that. And then and he was political in a sense, and that may have been part of it. The other one was Pat Dixon. We studied in our basement, so two things prepared me for the bar. One was taking Judge Grauman's course, and the other thing was Pat Dixon, Don Logson, and I, the three musketeers, studied in my mother's basement for weeks and weeks in preparation for the bar exam. And so those were the things that prepared me. And Pat Dixon then had laid out for himself a political career. It didn't come to fruition because Pat died at a relatively early age and didn't really have a chance to see it all the way through, but I may have had some inkling on that.
If that's okay. Yes, this is Kevin Collins, and we've had a 10-minute pause on this recording of Friday, May 14, 2010, and we'll now pick up the interview again. Congressman, we left off with your graduation from law school, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And that was in 1960?
Right.
And so what was your, when you get out of law school, what were your ambitions at that time? And probably to find a job, I would assume.
Well, actually, I had three opportunities in my senior year, and you sort of start looking around for what will you do once law school is ended. I had done some clerking for a local law firm during my law school years, just a little bit of brief work. It turned out that the same firm that I had clerked with became a very much larger firm in the process of my congressional career. So when I came back home in 95, I did join that law firm, so there's a certain amount of the circle closing. I clerked with them in 1958 or 59, and then joined them as a member of the firm in 2000, in 1995. But as far as the job, it was working with the, I had three choices. One was to clerk for a federal judge. One was to teach at what is now part of Northern Kentucky University, their law school. But it was then called Salmon Chase, S-A-L-M-O-N, Salmon Chase School. And it was in Cincinnati in the basement of the YMCA building. So I had a clerk career, a teaching career, or I could have joined the L&N Railroad Company in their law department. That's a Louisville and Nashville railroad company. In their law department. And so this was 1960. Michael had been born. Kids were coming. Bills had to be paid, et cetera. And so after talking things over with Helen, I took the job for the L&N, with the L&N Railroad Company.
And what was the name of the firm at that time?
It was
the L&N.
Yeah, that's right.
It was the law department of the L&N Railroad.
Exactly right. It's okay. What you call, yeah. It was the law department of the Louisville and Nashville Railroad Company.
Right.
And, you know, I get a back up on that, though, Kevin. In 1960, I got out of law school in 1960. Yeah, Helen, that's what it was. Michael had not been born. Mike was not born until 1960. Terrible, my God. I'm getting a little bit punchy here. But I think that Mike was born in 1960, and Andrew was born in 63. That's it. So is that tally up? Okay, that's all right. But in any event, after talking things over with Helen, it was decided by our joint vote that I should join the L&N Railroad Company because it was, I think it was the grand total of about $7,000 a year, but it was steady money and it was something that we could predict and count on, and with the kids coming, it gave us that little bit of insurance. Helen had been teaching during my senior year of law school, but she couldn't teach anymore now because she was pregnant. So it was a wonderful thing that happened. I would have probably enjoyed clerking with the judge. He was a good man. I would have probably enjoyed teaching, but happily, without my knowing it, I came back to teaching after I came back from Washington. I taught at the law school here for a few years, and so I was able to actually get back into teaching at a later point in my life. But working with the LNN was very important, and not just because it had a certain stipend connected with it. That was really incidental. The most important thing, there were three lawyers who were just extremely influential in my life. One of them was Elbert Lee, L-E-I-G-H, who was one of the attorneys that did a lot of work in Washington. He was one of the traveling attorneys. And in those days, everything the railroad did, everything, from the time the railroad got out of bed in the morning until the time the railroad turned off the lights at night, everything had to be cleared with the Interstate Commerce Commission, the famous ICC. And the ICC was the constant companion of all the railroad companies of America. It permitted them, or it did not permit them, to do everything that they did. So Elbert Lee was the one lawyer who was constantly going back and forth to Washington, and I was designated from time to time to go with Elbert. So I learned a lot about Washington, had some of my early experiences with looking at these major buildings. I'd never been to Washington but once earlier as a student. Had a chance to take part in these really amazing proceedings that took place in these amazingly ornate rooms in the what they call the Federal Triangle. And so he was very important, and he gave me a chance to be a part of the action a bit. And the other two lawyers, one was Joe Lenihan, whose sister just passed away the other day. Joe has been dead himself for some time. Joe Lenihan was an assistant solicitor. They had these very archaic terms for the railroad lawyers. They called them solicitors, and you know, almost like the inns of court in London. And but Joe was not only an extraordinarily talented railroad lawyer, he was just a remarkable human being, a devoted religious man, a devoted family man. He and his sister, Joe did never marry, but he was devoted to his extended family. He taught all of us who were the railroad lawyers of that era a lot about how to practice railroad law, but even more than that, how to write, how to research, how to put words on paper that were persuasive, how to put words on paper that were properly chosen, grammatically correct, syntactically correct. He was what I would say in the perfect sense of the word, a wordsmith. He knew words and he knew law. And he was such a genuinely decent, wonderful, affable human being that it just made it all very attractive. And he worked hand in hand, hand in glove with William Grubbs, G-R-U-B-B-S, who was the general counsel. He was the head lawyer. His son Billy and I still get together. Bill Jr. still practices law. And as the years have gone on, he more and more resembles his dad, too, which is kind of interesting. But Mr. Bill Grubbs was a great, as Joe. I mean, these were two very religious men. Joe was Catholic, Bill Grubbs was a Protestant, but they were both men of deep faith, both men who practiced the biblical admonitions of be charitable to one another, love people, do good work, be honest, never try to pull a fast one. They were very, very strong railroad lawyers. They believed in the railroads. They did not believe in truck lines. They believed that railroads were the underpinning of America, and they would let everybody know it, and they let the ICC know it. But they were wonderful teachers, and so I have a revered book in my library at home, which I'm going to give to U of L, written by Mr. Grubbs, a book about Jesus, and in it he inscribes it to me, and which I treasure very much. But he taught me a lot about how to write, as did Joe Lenihan, and just how to be a person of faith who also is a person of the world. And the two of them connected. They were both men of faith, deep faith, and men of the world, deeply involved in the affairs of the world. And sometimes they say the twain don't meet. You're one or you're the other. They proved you could be both.
How long were you with the railroad as an attorney?
A very brief time, only 2 years. I learned a lot in those 2 years, but I guess the part that I learned about that was that while being with the railroad was like being a civil servant in the federal government, which is to say you would always have a job, you'd never be without a job. On the other hand, the processes were as slow as a glacier, glacially slow, the movement, the process. And I could look ahead to see that it would be years upon years upon years before I would be doing a great deal differently than what I was then doing. Mm-hmm. And I guess I was impatient, impetuous, just like we'll talk at some point about running three political races in 3 years, basically. I mean, I guess I was, I keep saying, sort of young and crazy. I never found myself to be ambitious. In fact, I think that probably one of my problems in life was not being ambitious enough. But I guess I must have been looking ahead at the LNN to see that it would be pretty long before much different would happen. It wasn't an uncomfortable feeling at all. I mean, you know, something is there and I fit into it very nicely. They thought I had talent.
But it did expose you to life in Washington, D.C. and political life in Washington, D.C.
It did, and it came, you know, John Kennedy was elected in 1960, the year that I joined the LNN Railroad was that election year. So I would go up there with Elbert Lee on and off for the next 2 years, and we'd sit at the veranda of the Washington Hotel on 17th Street and look over the Treasury Building into the backyard of the White House. And here is Camelot. You know, I'm kind of witnessing Camelot. So as I've told you before, and as we'll get into more detail about the start of my political career, John Kennedy fit into it. You know, the fact that here's a young guy, 43 years old, burst onto the scene, and, you know, I'm sort of part of it, vicariously looking over the Treasury Building into the White House grounds, and it obviously planted a seed in my head, was gestated for a while, but then it eventually came to pass.
It seems like the experiences from grade school on up go in a circular kind of way, expanding and expanding and expanding, and then your military service and then your railroad service or your railroad employment.
Right.
At this time, it still hasn't dawned on you that you might be interested in a political career.
To the best of my knowledge, Kevin, I can't. Maybe Helen could fill in some gaps. Maybe I said something to her that indicated I was thinking of politics earlier than I believe I did. But I can't remember thinking anything that this would be my life. It was interesting and fascinating, and I was really aware of what potential there was in a public setting to do things for people, to be of influence. But I can't really put my finger on it except for that day, the fateful day, I guess, in 1967, when I walked past Democratic headquarters, which was then down at 4th and Main, between Main and the river, between Market and the river, and passed by Democratic headquarters. It was just a storefront. And walked in and introduced myself to the lady behind the counter and asked this fairly sophomoric question, you know, how do you get to be in politics? And she told me the people you had to check with, the things you had to do, write letters, get their support, and then you'd be the candidate of the party. And I did all those things. However, they didn't find me to be the proper person at the proper time, and so they endorsed another guy, mm-hmm. another fellow, who is a good man and still alive, I believe, mm-hmm. whose son I know is practicing law still. And so then it was up to Helen and me to decide, do we want to pursue something like that? Do we want to take on what some would call a quixotic battle mm-hmm. against the establishment? And understand neither one of us had ever been in politics before. It was really a sort of almost a bizarre to think that we could take on the party with all of its knowledge of campaigning and things like that and actually win. But maybe John Kennedy, maybe the odds, you know, there was odds against him to be elected president against Richard Nixon. And it may have been just, it was fun, you know, a way to, you can have fun because the Camelot people all seem to have fun. They threw footballs on Cape Cod and in that terrible, I can't think of the family compound at Hyannisport. Yeah, you know, and they're throwing footballs and they're sailing and they're looking like, God, it can be a lot of fun while you're president and attorney general. I mean, great fun.
Well, we'll do a tape on campaigning.
That's
and
right.
Do that pretty
it'd
soon. So we'll
fun,
probably,
yeah.
If you help to remind me, pick it up there when you walk into the Democratic headquarters in 1967. So just to finish up for today anyway, you finish as a railroad lawyer about 1962, mm-hmm. and most of the work that you do involves the ICC and the law department for Louisville and Nashville Railroad.
I didn't really practice a case. I was always assisting somebody else. I would do the research and the writing and do some of the legal brief preparation. And in the case of Albert Lee, I would accompany him on to Washington, not constantly, but often, and when he would then actually make the oral presentation and do that sort of thing. So I was there as a somewhat of an acolyte, I guess you'd say, to the established railroad lawyers. Okay. I have one wonderful thought, because the railroads were very frugal. As a matter of fact, they would never let us fly to Washington. We had to take the trains up there. And since L&N was a freight line, we had to use either the C&O, Chesapeake in Ohio, or the B&O, the Baltimore in Ohio. And we'd take these overnight sleepers and then wind up at Union Station in Washington and then, you know, begin our day. But frugality was the name of the game for the railroads. They didn't waste anything. They didn't, you know, give money away. And I remember going up to Washington once with a fellow named Ray Henriot, who's passed away. But Ray was one of those railroad lawyers who went to ICC quite often. I traveled with him once. And so it came time for lunch. And so Ray said, "Well, you want to have lunch?" I said, "Well, yeah, sure." So then we took off out of this thing and started walking. And we walked for a block or so and saw this, you know, very nice restaurant. And I thought he would stop. Well, he kept walking. And we kept going, and he passed another block or so, and passed another, you know, very nice looking kind of restaurant, and kept going. And the long story short, eventually he made a beeline into a F.W. Woolworth, a Woolworth store that had a lunch counter. So here we are, two railroad lawyers sitting at a lunch counter having, you know, the blue plate special, whatever the heck it was. And I'll never forget that. I mean, we walked and walked and walked because he was finding the cheapest place. Chances are that's the only thing the L&N permitted him to spend was, you know, a couple of bucks per lunch. So, but anyway, I thought that was cool. The fact that you had to take the train, couldn't take the air, couldn't fly, and that you find the cheapest meals that you could find. That was my L&N.
You finish up with L&N Law Department about 1962.
Exactly.
And then what's your next employment?
I went to work with a law firm at the 4th and Broadway, and the building that's been since imploded, but it was the Commonwealth Life Insurance Building. And I worked with Jerry Lloyd, L-L-O-Y-D, Jerry Lloyd, who later worked together with Fred Goldberg. So it was Goldberg and Lloyd, originally Lloyd, and then it became Goldberg and Lloyd, but a small law firm that did a lot of collection work. They did a lot of small claims work. Fred was sort of into corporate work. He's got a big, big law firm now, a huge law firm in Louisville, but in those days it was pretty small. And I joined him, and what I got was office space, the use of a part-time secretary who later came with me to the federal service, Miss Gilardi. Vicki Gilardi was at that law firm. So I got a part use of a legal secretary, use of the equipment, a small office, and for which I could, I had to carry papers back and forth, file their papers, make appearances to get court dates assigned, and things of that nature. And if I could get any cases of my own, they could be my own. I, you know, I could have these small cases. So that was my entry into the practice of law, where I was able to earn some money with, you know, getting business of my own, writing some wills, doing a little individual personal injury work, collection work. But at the meantime, my primary function was to serve the other lawyers in that office by making sure that all the papers got to the courthouse on time. I could pick things up, drop things off, get court assignments, and so that was my job from 1962 until 1968, when I was took office as a state senator. So that was through 1967, which was the election year. In 1968, because I was spending more time in Frankfurt, it didn't work out. Then one of the guys from the law firm and I went in the same building, either up some floors or down some floors. I have to look at the stationery, but I think it'll be in that stationery that I brought in here. But anyway, we opened up a little law office, Jim Woodson and Ron Mazzoli, and that's where I was from roughly 1968 until I wound up being elected to Congress in 1970, and then just left the practice of law entirely. So from 1962 until roughly 68, I was with Goldberg and Lloyd. From 68 to 70, Woodson and Mazzoli. Mm-hmm. And then from 1970, out of law entirely, out of law practice. I don't have any memorable recollections of the law. I didn't handle any major cases. I didn't wasn't involved in any court trials of note. I might back up just a little bit that when I was in that in 1962, Judge Grauman, I mentioned Judge Grauman as being one of my mentors when it came to the bar exam. Mm-hmm. Lawrence Grauman, also as a sitting circuit judge, could appoint what are called guardians ad litem. Mm-hmm. And a guardian ad litem represented people who couldn't represent themselves, people who were incarcerated, people who were had been committed to mental institutions. And so he could appoint guardians ad litem to then appear at hearings to determine the mental state of an individual and whether or not that person could stand trial, was compos mentis. And so for each one of those, my recollection was, I think you're paid $25, but for us it was like manna from heaven for Helen and me, because I could drive out to Whips Mill Road or LaGrange Road or something like that. In those days it was like in the middle of nowhere, but there was what's called Central State Hospital, mm-hmm. which is in Lakeland, and that's where the people were who were arrested maybe, or whose parents or wives or friends felt that they were not mentally stable.
Right.
And that's where they went. And then there was eventually a hearing to see should they be released or should they be kept for further treatment. And that's where I showed up. So I credit Judge Grauman with having helped Helen and me earn a little pin money for the kids and for ourselves, while I was at the same time doing a little bit of work with Goldberg and Lloyd, and then with Woodson and Mazzoli. And so then I did clerk, as I mentioned. So there were a few jobs I said earlier, not correctly, that I had no job prior to the LNN, except with my father. There mm-hmm. was that clerkship that I had for a couple of different clerkships.
Well, perhaps we should wrap it up. Okay. Briefly, reminiscences of the time you taught at Bellarmine?
Oh, those were wonderful times. I succeeded Henry Shue, SCHOO. Henry was a longtime teacher of the business law course at Bellarmine, but his practice developed better and he needed the time. I'm not sure exactly how I heard about the job, but I think I heard about it from Henry himself. And so I applied to Bellarmine, and they accepted me as a teacher in the night school of business law. And so I taught from 19, probably somewhere in the vicinity of 63, 64 until until I went to the state senate. So there were about 3 or 4 years of there I was teaching the business law course. And to this day, men come up to me, because it was almost an all-male school and then mostly a male class, and say, "You don't remember me, Mr. Mazzoli, but..." And then they'll say, "Well, you taught me business law." And so even now, it's nice to hear from the guys. But it was important for one thing. I probably learned a little bit about business law, which probably wasn't harmful. But mostly, prior to that time, I had not really done any public speaking of any particular note. I had been involved in club activities, and I'd probably been on my feet in classrooms and stuff like that. But basically, truthfully, I'd never done public speaking. Well, here I had a class to manage. I had to develop the syllabus. I had to conduct the evening program. I had to set forth and give them some idea of what lay ahead. I had to also field questions, answer questions that I might not have been prepared to answer, try to answer them in ways that they could understand, and answer them correctly. So I think that it probably was one of the most important preparations for me for what later became my career, which was public service, where you have to be on your feet. You have to give statements. You have to show plausibly why you voted for this or plausibly why you voted against that. You have to be able to convince people. You have to be able to persuade them if you're running for office. And you have to do it most of the time on your feet, most of the time on display. And so here was a situation where I really did have to do that. And I did that when sometimes sweat was pouring off my face. You can't rub it off. It's a sign of weakness. Sweat's running down my shoulder blades. You can't try to, you know, rub yourself. You can't do it. You have to just endure it. There are times when you're speaking as if a bucket is over your head, like it's going nowhere. All you hear is that resonance coming back. You say, "Good God, why am I here?" So I credit those Bellarmine years as being very, very, very formative for me in the career path that later emerged in, you know, 67. So mm-hmm. I was teaching before this crystal of an idea that might have been planted in 1960 by John Kennedy, might have been planted at the Hotel Washington on the veranda having a drink looking over into the White House grounds. It might have been planted by Pat Dixon in my mother's basement as we studied for the bar exam, and he was going through his wonderful plotting and scheming of how he was going to be a politician of note. And he would have been if he had lived long enough, because he was a very talented guy. But one way or the other, this teaching was done prior to that moment of that eureka moment when I said, "Yes, I'm going to be running for office." So it was a prep for it, though, and a prep in a very, very special way.
Ah. Well, it's been a fascinating session on this first tape, and I just wanted to ask you if there's anything we haven't covered that you'd like to mention before we close this session out.
Two very quick things. One is, going back to Notre Dame, here's Ron Mazzoli from the state of Kentucky, which for many of the guys who came from Massachusetts or Connecticut or New York or New Jersey, they say Kentucky? God, that must be some wild, terrible place. I mean, the hinterlands of Kentucky. You know, anyway, I was considered a sort of a person from the country, though Louisville was anything but a country city, even in those days. But Kentucky, they look down, do you wear shoes? Anyway, I said I was going to get back at those guys, these big city fellas, you know, these sophisticated Eastern Seaboard guys, these sophisticated New Englanders. So when I got to Notre Dame, maybe not the first year, but soon, I brought my old Victrola with a 78 speed and my big vinyl discs of, not, though I love Pavarotti, Pavarotti hadn't come on the scene in those days. My dad was a great opera fan. We used to listen to the Metropolitan Opera of the Air every Saturday. He loved Italian opera. No, none of that. I brought Bill Monroe and the Bluegrass Boys, Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs, and I brought Hank Williams, among other so bluegrass music and that early real country music, not this real sophisticated popular country music. And I would play those records of a Saturday night, And I know I was driving those New Englanders and the New Yorkers and the New Jerseyites crazy with this music that was dissonant. You know, they never heard music like that. So I figured that if they were going to consider me to be sort of a country-fied fella that came from a state that wasn't really a state at all, it didn't really exist, it was where the poorest of the poor people lived or something, I was going to pay them back a little bit with that. The other thing has to do with Fort Knox, and that is that my field sergeant, there was a 19-year-old kid. We were 21. He was younger than we were. He had been, he was in the Korean War, came out of the hills of West Virginia, perhaps a high school graduate, maybe not, went to Korea, came back with a combat infantry badge, a real soldier. He had his clothes were crisply pressed, and he was just a real, well, we got to this barracks, a platoon, and he was our platoon sergeant, and he was, I would, into his face later, because we became friends and close friends later on in life, but I called him Caligula incarnate. I called him the return of Attila the Hun. He was just, I thought, the meanest of the mean guys. He would take, in those days we had two-floor barracks, no air conditioning, no nothing, and he would fall us in, fall us out, run down to the company street, assemble, run back into your barracks, stand by your bunk, then he'd blow the whistle, run back down those steps, out to the country, to the company street. Anyway, back and forth, back and forth. It was Mickey Mouse with capital M's, but it was meant, I didn't know at the time, it was meant to teach us how to be soldiers, and in the process, teach us how to be men. And I mentioned earlier, I learned how to take a rifle apart under a blanket. I learned how to polish my boots so you could be a mirror. I learned how to sew. I learned how to iron and press. I learned how to march. I learned how to do a lot of things. But Sergeant Wade Dameron, if there's ever been a more beautiful name for somebody, Wade Dameron. You can just see him riding out of something, you know, just perfect name. Well, Wade Dameron was our sergeant. He was this young kid, flaming red hair, not a very tall man, but broad, strong. And it turned out that we became friends in a kind of different way, because Wade, in later life, when I was in Congress, I asked the Army to look him up for me. He had retired by that time at Fort Jackson. We visited in Washington. He became a very prominent businessman in South Carolina. He and his wife, Joanne, and periodically we talked to Joanne. Wade passed away. But we became friends, and he told me this wonderful story. He said, Ron, you didn't know this, but I didn't have much of an education. He said, and I would be in my, the sergeant had a little walled-off part in the corner of the second floor of the barracks. He said, you didn't know, but I would sit there in my room and I would listen to you guys talking, and I didn't always understand what you were saying. I didn't always know those words that you were using. And we were not that erudite that we were using huge words. We were just talking what possibly college graduates would normally be saying and using the word structure that you would use. Mm-hmm. Nothing elaborate, but the normal stuff. But for him, it was like opening a door to a new world. And so Wade, being the devoted soldier that he was, and being later who became the very prominent and successful businessman he became, and a wonderful father and husband, hied himself up to the library at the top of the hill at Fort Knox, and started checking books out, and started reading, and started trying to figure out what was going on around him beyond Army stuff. And as it turned out, Kevin, he later earned his degree, because I think it's the University of Maryland has campuses in all these foreign posts. So as Wade went around the world in his military career, he became the highest ranking non-commissioned officer you can be, like a command sergeant major. As he went around the world with the military, he would always take courses from the University of Maryland, earned his degree. Later, when he and Joanne retired at Fort Jackson and remained at South Carolina, then he was able to do things first with Blue Cross Blue Shield, then with his own logistics company. So And like I mentioned, we became great friends. He visited. We had lunch in the Capitol many times on his visits to Washington. Flew his own airplane. I mean, it was really quite interesting. And it all emerged from this second floor of the barracks at Fort Knox, where this young 19, 20-year-old pugnacious kid was overhearing conversations that were being held in that same barracks area. And I said, Wade, you know, it's interesting. You learn from us, right? You learn certain words, and you were inspired to go to learn more, and you did. I learned from you, because, like I said, here was this monster who was moving us back and forth and screaming in our ear and in our face and making us run up and down, in and out, and dying on the vine. Would open a locker, and if it wasn't just right, he'd tumble that damn locker over, and you'd have to try to put all the stuff, because you had to, where your socks went, where your underwear went, where the combs and brushes, everything had to be absolutely in order. Your standing locker the same way, clothes. I said, Wade, what you were telling us is how you've got to learn to live with people. Like I mentioned, we had African Americans in the same room. You have to learn how to function as a team. You have to learn how to keep yourself neat and clean. You have to learn how to do jobs you don't necessarily want to do, but they add to your storehouse of knowledge. You taught us how to function in unnatural terrain, like when you're crawling on your belly and, you know, they do simulated fire over your head. So he was teaching me how to be a man. He was teaching me things that I would never have learned except for him. Mm-hmm. And so he learned from us, Kevin. It was like a reciprocity. Mm-hmm. He learned from us, but we in turn learned from him. From that experience, and of course later in my Army career, I learned in a sense of learning the shorthand, which then led me to my career. So I look at Wade Dameron, and we had many wonderful conversations in our lives thereafter. Including once Helen and I went to South Carolina and stayed with him and with Joanne. And it turned out that the Army, which I said I was very much reluctant to get into, was in a very important part of my life.
Mm-hmm. He sounds like a remarkable fellow.
He was a remarkable man. I wish he were alive today, because I'm sure he would love to be interviewed. Somewhere I'll find an Army picture of him. I know I have it. And you will see in him that round face with that flaming red hair, and he was one tough cookie, but he was a tough cookie in the right way.
Well, I've appreciated your time and your memory,
Kevin.
Particularly.
Thank you.
And look forward to the next tape that we do.
Sounds very good.
Thank you very much,
sir. You're a good man. Thank you. Good. Well, that went very well. That was a lot of fun.
You were comfortable?
Oh, yeah, very much so.
Good.
I enjoy thinking about these things and thinking about these people. And you got everything done. Everything done. Jobs
when I make notes, it's not for a record as much as it is in our conversation. I don't want to forget the person's name,
that's
and if
great.
I have to refer back to it, it
you're
helps
what you
keep
call
it going
a multitasker.
That way,
so. I could never do that. I'm either going to be, you know, taking notes and not doing the interviewing, or do the interviewing and not take notes.
Well, that's because I nap in the daytime. Thank you, sir.
That was great. Thanks very much, Kevin. I appreciate it.
I suppose we want to go back and talk to Kathy.